You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 466. By the time a man is wise enough to watch his step, he's too old to go anywhere. Billy Crystal.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, today on the show, we have a living legend. I was lucky enough to sit down and speak to the one, the only, Billy Crystal. Now, if you don't know who Billy Crystal is, then you're probably a lot younger than I am. But Billy has been in films like Throw Mama from the Train, When Harry Met Sally, City Slickers, The Princess Bride, Analyze This, Analyze That, America's Sweethearts, Monsters, Inc. and its sequel, and many, many more films. He has also hosted the Oscars 9 times, has had a hit television show called The Comedians, was a writer and performer on Saturday Night Live, wrote and directed films like Mr. Saturday Night, Forget Paris, My Giant, American Sweethearts, and his latest film, Here Today, co-starring Tiffany Haddish. Now, it was an absolute honor to talk to Billy and, you know, just talk to someone who had such an impact on my life growing up and throughout my life. Billy's always been there to make me smile in one way, shape, or form, and always do it with a little bit of heart, made you feel things just a little bit differently. It wasn't a cheap laugh. It was something that came from the soul in so, so many ways. And we also talk about that new film he just directed and wrote, Here Today with Tiffany Haddish, which I had the pleasure of watching. And I have to tell you, it is wonderful, and it's a film that we need right now in the world. It is funny. It is heartfelt. It makes you think. There's going to be a conversation afterwards. It just pulls on every single emotion you can imagine in this film. It is wonderful, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Billy Crystal. I'd like to welcome to the show Billy Crystal. How are you doing, Billy?
I'm great. Nice to see you, Alex.
Thank you so much for being on the show. It is, I am humbled and honored to have you on the show. Truly, when I was speaking to, like I was telling you earlier, I was speaking to my wife that I was going to have you on the show, and we both kind of geeked out a minute. It took us a minute. We kind of geeked out, and we just kind of like, oh my God, it's Mr. Crystal. And I'm not going to embarrass you, but, when I was growing up in high school, I was in a video store Wait a minute. Calm down.
Now. I know. But, you know, when I was a kid, I loved you.
No.
Before I was born, my mother was listening to City Slickers. I heard you in the womb.
No, I'm not that young. I'm not that young. Thank you, though, for saying that. But I'm not that young. When I was in high school, it was the 80s, late 80s, early 90s. So that was kind of like a really magical time for your career, from Running Scared in 86, When Harry Met Sally, City Slickers, and that whole kind of that run. So, you know, you've been a very big part of my life growing up. And I just want to say thank you. Before we even get started, thank you for all the amazing things you've done over the years. And now my daughters, when I told them, they go, my daughters now who are nine, they say, I told them like, oh, they always want to know who I'm talking to. I'm like, oh, I'm talking to Mr. Billy Crystal. And they tell me, and they go, City Slickers? And I go, Really? Yeah, because I showed them City Slickers the other day, literally like probably a month or two ago, we showed them City Slickers and they loved it. And then they go, what else has he done? I'm like, oh, he's Mike Wazowski. And their eyes just explode. They're like, you're talking to me.
When I have four grandchildren. So when they first started to be aware of Grandpa in a different way, other than the guy who carried them and put them into bed and stuff. So now we were walking in a very interesting, beautiful mall here called The Grove and in L.A., and some paparazzi just started taking pictures of us. And it was weird for them. What is it? Because I hadn't mentioned anything. Mm-hmm. And they were little, you know. So I said, well, you know, I'm in the movies. I do movies. And who? Well, I'm Mike Wazowski. And they flipped out. They just flipped out, like your daughters, except they're my granddaughters. So Right. They would call the house looking for Mike Wazowski. So if I answered, hello, oh, is Mike there? I'd have to be, hold on, I'll get him. That went on for like 3 years. I mean, it was just every day, I'll get him. Oh, I said, is it those kids again? Yeah, Mike. So I appreciate it. You know, we have a new series coming out called Monsters at Work, which will debut July 2nd on Disney Plus. We just finished 10 of them, John Goodman and I, and a whole new cast of wonderful new characters. Mm-hmm. So it'll be kicked up again, you know. Okay. But then, listen, if it's Mike, they know me by. I'm very happy about that. He's one of my, if not my favorite character I've ever played.
He's that the Monsters Inc. I mean, we have to get started with Monsters Inc. I mean, when I first started, like that last scene, just like tears. Just, I mean, I don't care if you don't have a heart, you have to cry in that movie. It's amazing. It's amazing. Now, how did I want to let the audience? I want to go back a little bit into your career. How did you get started in the business?
Well, it's two separate kind of answers, Alex. I mean, I got started when I was about 3-4 years old, literally making your parents laugh, your relatives laugh. I had two older, funny brothers. They're hilarious still. And, you know, when you're the youngest and the shortest, you tend to be the loudest. So I had a fight for my spot, you know, and usually when we had an act together, I would close. And I'd be on the coffee table, and I was sort of like a little Jewish Don Rickles at 3, 4, 5 years old. I could imitate them and so on and so forth. And that never stopped. Mm-hmm. That just has never stopped. And when I graduated from NYU Film School, I had two wonderful friends that we did improv together, because I was always, you know, still doing comedy in some way. And we formed a comedy group, and we were together for a long time, like 4 years. But all during that time, I knew that I was sort of hiding and that I needed to be out there by myself, that I was at my heart really a stand-up. Mm. And so after 4 years, towards the end, it was just a really mostly hard time. I had a baby already, and I was substitute teaching in the junior high school that I went to. And which was weird, because I'd be in the teacher's dining room and they were teachers that I had. And now they said, it's okay to call me by my first name. And I would say, no, you're still Mr. Graff. You're Mr. Tardino. You know, I can't. So then we started working. And I said, I just got to get off on my own. And out of the blue, a friend of mine calls from NYU and said, listen, do you know anyone who could do stand up at a fraternity party a ZBT house on Mercer Street in the Village. And I instantly said, I'll do it. And he goes, well, when did you start doing stand-up? I said, oh, I've been doing it for a while. Lied my ass off. Put together a bunch of, you know, like 10, 15 minutes that I thought would be okay. You know, this was a Tuesday and the gig was a Friday night. This might work, that might work, but I just had to do it. And I got up there that night and I just exploded. I just improvised for like an hour. And that was, there was no turning back. I mean, that was really it for me. So that was like 1973 and change.
And I mean, I've worked with stand-ups a lot in my career as a director, and it's hard to improv. It is hard to get up on that stage and do, you know, and you always think you're the funny guy. You're like, oh yeah, I could tell jokes, yeah, with three or four people, but you get in front of a bunch of strangers with that light on you and that mic, all of a sudden you're not as cute as you might have thought you were.
Yeah, no, it's until you get your feet underneath you and your brain working the right way.
Right.
And you're able to put yourself into your act, you know, and not just do like an act, but talk about what's important to you and find the funny about that. Then that's really something, you know. For me, it's you know, all these years later, there's only a few places I'm really comfortable in my own skin, and on stage is one of them.
Now, what did stand up do as far as helping you prepare for the very gentle and inviting and warm film industry?
I got to think about that. You know, it's hard when you do your own things and you believe in what you're doing. And then suddenly, as you're starting to show work to people who tell you no, but, or we don't like that, we like this, and it's a different audience, but a powerful one, because they can say yes or no. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, it still is always a challenge. That's why I, you know, with Here Today, I am so thrilled that we were able to get something made and finished during the pandemic, but that we were able to write a funny, moving movie, a full emotional journey for an audience. And I have to say, at this age, to get something done and have people embrace it, the studio people embrace it, like Sony has. With this movie. But the stand-up, it's always the place that I return to for new ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, if and money, but it's
I mean, mostly money. It's mostly money. Let's just be honest.
It's just a downtime and God knows there have been. You know, well, this isn't happening. That's not happening. Let's book some dates and I'll go out on the road. Like 3 years ago, I did 35 cities and I had the greatest time. And then your mind starts getting all oiled up, you know, and you start seeing things differently. And then, you know, we were on the road, you know, and Janice and I have been married almost 51 years. So right from the beginning, she'd be making notes in the audience for me. Or I'd run back to the motel after I did a gig and she'd be there and we'd go over the notes and so on. So now, 3 years ago, we're running back to the hotel and doing the notes. You know, and then seeing, oh, that could be this, that could go that could be, that's funny. That didn't work. And then it's all how it started out and it all feels very right.
That's amazing. And it's amazing that that you still as you were explaining it to me, you were like a 20-year-old. You were like a kid, like, yeah, and then we got this and that, the juice is flowing and we got this and that and this and that. And it is fascinating the creative mind and how it works. Especially, again, the stand-up comic is a very interesting creature, to say the least.
Well, the thing about it I love the most are the surprises.
Right.
And it's thrilling. It is absolutely thrilling when you can knit together an entire sequence off the top of your head because the juice of the audience is so good. And then it's like, you know, there's a power about it that's it's very hard to explain unless you experience it yourself. Yeah. You're walking, you're talking, you're thinking ahead. It's almost like chess. There's three moves. You're setting up things. You're setting the audience up where they don't see it coming. But when you get on a riff and it just comes and you get on a roll, it's really something. It still is a great feeling to have.
Now, I have to ask you this because my father told me I have to ask you this. He was a monstrous fan of Soap. One of your early shows that really kind of arguably kind of blew you into the mainstream a bit. And yes. and your character, Jody, that you brought to life on Soap I remember watching it later, like when I was in high school, I would watch episodes and my father just was just obsessed. He couldn't stop laughing with that film, with that show. But it was a pretty, pretty bold character in the late 70s to be bringing out a gay character on television. Were you the first? I don't even know if you were the first.
Yeah, I was the first recurring starring character in a network television show. Right. There were other like films, but nobody, you know, approached it with humor.
Right.
The way that the brilliant, really, you know, they say, boy, he's a genius. Susan Harris, who created Soap, was a genius to me. She wrote the first 65 or 68 episodes all by herself.
Wow.
For a lot of characters. You know, we had like at least 12 main characters and then supporting characters and one-date people and so on and so forth that would come in and out of the story. The jokes were great. The characters were fantastic, an amazing cast, and Jody Dallas was when they approached me about playing him after seeing me on a Tonight Show with Johnny, and I met with him, and I was nervous about it until I met with him, and it was Susan and her late husband Paul Witt and Tony Thomas, great producers. And to me, the best director in television at the time, Jay Sandridge, who was Mary Tyler Moore director and just one of the MTM heavyweights. And we talked for a long time about, well, where's he going? What's to be said? You know, how honest is this going to be? And it started out honestly a little rubbery, I thought. And then it settled in. Into a real interesting, thoughtful, funny, stood up for himself, strong character who knew who he was. That most of the time, there was some confusion about his own sexuality and so on. But then, he just was very endearing to people. Wow. And it was 4 years of it. And I think the test of it, Alex, was... he had a one night stand and he ends up fathering a baby girl.
Yeah.
And his, the mother sues for custody and it was a big court battle. That was my story, you know, cause it was a soap opera. So your story comes around every couple of months sometimes, which was frustrating. But Jody wins custody of the baby and they did a poll. I remembered, I guess ABC did it, who should get the baby? And it was almost unanimous that Jody should get the child. And I thought that was the victory of the character.
Wow.
The trust for a gay, single gay man to get custody of the child. So I'm very proud of those years. You know, it was 4 years. I saw on Twitter, I don't know, 2 weeks ago was the last episode of Soap aired 1981, right. So I guess 2 weeks ago. I don't know. But it was a great group of actors to work with that really were supportive of me, knowing the pressure that I was under. And Richard Mulligan, who played Bert Campbell, was a genius. And Catherine Hellman, who passed away last year, also just really nurtured me. Mm-hmm. And Robert Guillaume, bless his soul, who played Benson.
Yeah.
You know, but Bob was very, very, he's such a strong man that to play a black servant for white people, rich white people, that he played it with dignity and with humor and sometimes was the only sane one in the cast. And sometimes we were both portrayed that way. The only two sane people are you know, the gay guy and Ben Benson, you know. Back then they would say stuff like that. And Bob was very nurturing for me. And, you know, he would wait for me when I would do a scene and I'd come off the set. He'd be like one of the first ones there to give me a hug and say, that was really good, so on and so forth. And we had a long talk about it once. And it was really beautiful. We said, you know, our two characters are minorities. And you know, so we have to stand up for each other. And it was a beautiful thing. All the people there were great, just great.
Well, I mean, from there, you're you know, a legendary actor who's been in so many classics. And I said, again, don't want to embarrass you, but you're a veteran actor who's been in tremendous amounts of.
You know what? I like legendary better than veteran. Yeah.
Well, but I mean,
I had a choice. Legendary always means he's old. You know, which I am, but you know, I'm in good shape, everybody.
You get paid more as legendary as opposed to veteran. I think that's generally the difference. But you've not only been in so many amazing films as an actor, but what a lot of people don't realize too is you're a very accomplished writer and also an accomplished director. And one of the things I've noticed in a lot of your writing and directing in some of your projects, but writing, is that you pull from your life experiences. As a writer with things like My Giant, Mr. Saturday Night, America's Sweethearts, The Comedians, do you find it easier to write that way? Like to pull from things that you know? Because I remember watching, it might have been one of those PR junkets from America's Sweetheart that you said the story. Like, yeah, we just kept doing these things. I'm like, this is kind of ridiculous. Someone should write a movie about this. And My Giant was about you and Andre and Princess Bride. Like, is that a fertile place for you to write from?
Oh, yeah. I think that's, you know, you write about what you know, what you feel. And, you know, the longer I'm around, the more material I have to draw on, either as a writer or as an actor, is life experience. And sometimes those aren't fun experiences. But, you know, I liken sometimes my work to Rumpelstiltskin, the fairy tale character who would turn straw into gold. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you take the straw in your life and you turn it into gold. And I did that, you know, throughout. You have to trust it, that if it's real and, you know, you make it something, you know, artistic. There's a line in here today is I take the truth and make it more interesting.
Yeah,
and as a writer, and you know that was very true for what 700 Sundays was on Broadway, was a story of my life and my relationship with my father, both alive and when he passed away, the aftermath of a sudden loss when I was just 15, and so yeah, so it's real and it's painful, but you know what happens, Alex, if you tell it the right way, when you're on stage, you see the audience nodding their heads.
Mm-hmm.
You see them engaged. You feel the laughter. Of course, you feel the tears. It's a very powerful feeling to be on stage, on like I did every night for years on Broadway, feeling the audience feeling your pain because they're feeling their own. And I think that comes with, you know, a confidence that sometimes you just have to unburden yourself. And let it go and just hope that it resonates.
Now, there was another movie that you did. I think it was your first, it was definitely your first feature that you were the star or carried it, which was Rabbit Test.
Ooh.
Yes.
I thought this was going to be pleasant. It was my first ever. Yeah, Joan Rivers directed it. It's about the world's first pregnant man. It's a farce. It's
It was fascinating because I saw, because first of all, it was a woman director back then was a big deal. I remember seeing her, and then she was in the marketing of it, but she wasn't in it. If I'm not mistaken, I remember that.
All the posters. But me with a belly and her pointing to it with it going like this, you know, yeah. And it something on her that said director person.
Right, exactly. It said director person.
Joan was, first of all, she was a phenomenal comedian, just hilarious person, and one of the hardest working, funny people I ever met was Joan. Yeah.
Yeah, and was that when you got that job as an actor? You're like, well, I'm a star of a movie. What did that feel like? I mean, back then.
First of all, I wasn't the first choice for that movie.
Okay,
and I have to say it because maybe he'll watch this, but we laugh about it every time we see each other. Dennis Dugan, who directs so many of Adam Sandler's films and is a really good, funny director and was a wonderful actor. He had a series called Richie Brockelman, Private Eye, and he was in Hill Street Blues all the time. And he shot for like a week. He was shooting for a week. So I was at a Dodger game and I remember there was an announcement. Billy Crystal to the white courtesy phone, please. Billy Crystal to the white courtesy phone. And my wife was pregnant at the time. So I was like, oh no. Is this having a baby now? No. So I run to the, hello, this is a Billy. Hi, it's Joan. Listen, I made a mistake. Can you come over to the house? You'll start tomorrow. Start tomorrow? What? The movie. It didn't work out with him. It was wrong. And so I have to leave the game. Go to her house, go open the script with her, and start the next day. That's how that happened.
Wow.
The highlight of that movie for me, and then we're Alex, no matter what you say, we're moving on.
Yes, absolutely.
was I got to work with Imogene Coca. And Imogene was from the original Sid Caesar, your show of shows at Caesar's Hour.
Yeah.
She was a genius comedic performer, comedy actress, and I just loved her. So I had a chance to work with her. So that was the highlight for me.
And now we will move on. Now, when you're writing, I always love to ask this about writers. Do you start with character or do you start with plot?
Well, here today started with sometimes it's just a whim. It's like, well, what about this? I'd like to do a story about that or something. And then you start like fleshing it out in your mind for weeks, making notes here. And then if you got something, you start to write it. Here today started totally out of the blue. My co-writer and one of my closest friends ever, Alan Zweibel. Alan was an original Saturday Night Live writer, created Rosanna Dana with Gilda. We've been friends. He was like the first friend I made in when I started doing stand-up. We lived near each other in Long Island, and I would pick him up on our way to a wonderful club called Catch a Rising Star on the Upper East Side of New York. We'd hope to get on by 1 o'clock. Then I'd drive him home. I lived an hour outside of Manhattan. We'd listen to our cassette tapes of our shows that we had just done, our sets, and help each other get better. So we were very, very close friends. And then I saw him, and he worked on 700 Sundays with me and collaborated with me on 700 Sundays and was invaluable. And then he's on Letterman, and he's telling this story about this auction luncheon that someone had purchased. He was the prize of this luncheon that someone had get to have lunch with him and you know, as we often do, and raise money for a charity. So he's at the restaurant with this woman who's really not into comedy at all. And he said, well, how much did you pay? I'm just curious. For the charity, he says, oh, $22. He says, oh, $2,200. That's good. He goes, no, $22.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So now he's sort of like hating her. But she's there. Then she has a reaction to the seafood salad she has. She blows up. She goes into shock. This is true, totally true story. He's telling the story on Letterman. It's hilarious. And he has to take her to the hospital. This total stranger. She doesn't have insurance. And his charity luncheon cost him, I think, like $2,200. So I'm watching the show, and you know, because he's on. And I start typing right away on my computer. And I sent him an email saying, Al, what a hilarious story. This is a great way for two people to meet. Who are they? Where do they go from here? If you're interested, this could be a really, really great way to launch a movie. So we talked the next day, and then we just started. You know, who could they be? What could happen to them? I wanted to do a story about an intergenerational teaming, and not a love story, but a love story, but not a romantic love story.
Right.
But a movie about friendship, about support, about empathy, which I feel is so lacking, mm-hmm. you know. And then you go, who are they? And so on and so forth. And Alan and I both had a very wonderful relationship with the senior writer at SNL from the beginning and from when I was there in 84, 85. And his name is Herb Sargent. And Herb was in his 50s when everybody wasn't. And he was very much who Charlie Burns is in Here Today. And we just loved him. He was witty. He was funny. He wrote most of the jokes for a Weekend Update in the beginning, helped create that section. And he just sort of like would roam around and approve or disapprove of what you were writing. You always asked him, you know, what do you think? And he'd give you an honest answer. And he was just the greatest. And so we thought that was a good guy. And then I was in Penn Station in New York. I was heading out by train, and I saw this little band, this woman singing with a combo in the waiting room at Penn Station. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Then I saw her again in Soho on the street with like a gypsy jazz band. And she was great. And I emailed Alan immediately and said, this is who she could be. She's a performer. She's got bravado. She's sassy. She, you know, and she's got a career that may happen and so on. So, and so then we started writing and then here we are, you know?
Yeah, I can't believe that most of the movie, which by the way, I saw and I had the pleasure of watching. And I, as I told you before we started recording, it is so there's so much heart in the film, and it just almost took my wife and I back. Because we're not used to watching content like that anymore, because it's just not something, unless you start going back into older movies of, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, that's what I kind of grew up with. You know, the City Slickers of the world and the When Harry Met Sally. There's heart in those films. There's heart in those stories. And it just was so wonderful. I can't believe that a lot of that was based on a true story.
It's a short story he wrote called The Prize, and Alan was the prize. And so it just took off from there. And then, you know, the added element of, you know, that he was had suffering from the early onset of a form of dementia was something that I was dealing with a relative of mine who was a novelist. It was my aunt, who was a brilliant woman. And she came to me one day and said, I'm losing my words. I'm losing my word. And I thought that was profound.
Yeah.
And took care of her. And we thought, well, you know, what if Charlie has that, a funny man who's losing his funny, who's losing his currency, which is his words, is starting to go broke, has a great deal of drama about it. And then, you know, as they become friends, for her to give up a promising career to take care of him is the ultimate kind of friendship and yeah. really defines love. So we decided to go that way and we did, and we're, you know, it's a really funny movie. Don't get me wrong.
How do you balance that? It's a pretty heavy conversation when you're talking about dementia, yeah. onset dementia, but yet it is funny and heartfelt. So you really balanced that so beautifully to the point where it wasn't too sad and it wasn't too funny. It just has a perfect kind of just right balance between them. How do you balance that as a writer and a director?
Well, it's you know, as the writer, that's, you know, Al and I were very careful in where we were going. And as a director, it's making it real and trusting the performers. And when you have somebody as wildly funny and charming as Tiffany and being able to play off her and counterbalance that with his appreciation for her and his affection for her, which grows. So the movie and the story grows on you. Keeping those at the right levels was really, you know, I think the task. And creating a whole other life for him, which I think is, for me, very interesting in the movie about his late wife, who comes to life in his mind, and shooting it with, you know, the subjective camera, which is me, and you get to know her, and you get to love this woman who, you know, was taken from him, and she's funny and she's charming So I would shoot her and I'd be right behind the camera. So she would talk right to the camera. So she's like talking to Charlie. Because when you remember things, Alex, you don't remember them in two shots or wide shots. Or you just remember what you see. Mm-hmm. So that was a choice I made while we were writing. I said I could shoot it this way. Because I knew right away I wanted to direct this. And I told Alan, I know what this should be. And when that happens, it's a wonderful feeling. I hadn't directed a film
in like 20 years
in a movie, which was just on the other night again 61. On HBO, honoring the 20th anniversary of 61 about Marison Mantle, who I knew very well. And I was so, I'm not in that movie, but there's as much of me in 61 as there is in here today. Because I love those guys in that year, but you have to just make sure that the balance is right. And it's a tricky one to pull off, but I know we did.
Now, how do you direct a force of nature like Tiffany Haddish? Like, I mean, she is a literal force of nature as a performer. She's so wonderful. And you guys have all the chemistry in the world, by the way. You could just tell that you love each other. How do you direct that? And not only direct it from off camera, but how do you direct it while you're in the scene with her? Like, that's a juggling act, to say the least.
Oh, for sure. She's a brilliant talent. And she from the time we first met, I told her what I needed from her and what I didn't want from her. Okay. And that, yes. So I said, I need Emma Page. And when there are moments where I need Tiffany, we'll plug those in. Yeah. But you have to, you know, and she was so grateful for the chance, I guess, and looking forward to it so much to stretch her talent. Mm-hmm. And she just gave herself over to what I wanted her to do. And if it wasn't comfortable, we'd talk like you would with any actor or actress. And then there are moments where I just let her sprinkle. You know, like, they need something here. What do you think? What do we got? I'm here. I'll be right there, you know. And so, and I needed her to get emotional in a way that she hadn't before, which she was very scared of. I said, and I kept telling her to just stay in these moments. It's hard, you know, with movies are frustrating to do because they're forever. And you have to hit that moment, you know, and as many takes as it is, the director needs to satisfy the movie. And movies are a collection of moments. So we have to get to a certain place. So there's a moment where she cries, which was very difficult for her to do. But I was sitting there with her on camera, and the camera's behind me. And she was fighting it because that's a natural instinct for anyone not to, you know, show emotion in their life, you know. And she had a tough childhood, and she, you know, would, and she didn't want to get there. But I talked to her just very quietly. And it's hard because the crew is all around. Right. So you clear out everybody that doesn't need to be there. It's just me and her and the camera behind us. And I just talked to her, and it came, and suddenly it's there. And it's a beautiful moment where she's listening to Charlie talk about the darkest moment in his life. And it's just bonds them forever. And, you know, I think she has extraordinary personality, and there's so much there for the world to see. And I'm excited for what she's going to do next.
You know, and I kind of can tell when you let her go a little bit, and when it was Emma and when it was Tiffany, because you can kind of sense that while you're watching, because I've watched Tiffany. I've been a huge fan of her. So I can see when she goes off the, you know, she does Tiffany. When she's Tiffany, you can tell. So like that scene in the bedroom with that's all Tiffany.
Yeah, let her go. And I, you know what? When we came to that English, I said, you know what? It's going. I love it. Yeah. It's just, she looks so cute with the way she smiles and looks at him.
It's so great. And
it's just a great little, but those are, you know, what Rob Reiner used to call freebies. Those are freebies.
Yeah.
You know, but that's when you work with somebody like that, and they can just do that. It was very exciting to, you know, and I'm sitting opposite her trying not to laugh and knowing this is good. And then she just went. And then, you know, in the editing room, I just said, no, let's keep that. I want that.
Yeah. Now, you've worked with some of the most remarkable film directors in history. Really remarkable, I mean, list of people you've worked with. What is the biggest lesson that you've taken from one of those directors, any one of them?
I guess Rob, because Rob's got a fantastic ear. Rob does. And there's a line that Charlie says in a meeting with the two other head writers of the show that he works on in the movie. And he turns to her and says, there's a music to comedy. There were notes.
Yeah, it's a great line.
Notes. And that was very much a Rob thing about when we were doing Harry and Sally, about hearing it the right way. The inflection, which drives Charlie crazy when they...
Oh, my God, the inflection thing was... Yeah. That blow-up was genius. Oh, my God, that was great.
And, so I think, you know, Rob, sure. And then directing yourself, I learned so much from... I love this guy, Danny DeVito. I just adore Danny.
Yes.
And Throw Mama from the Train is a really, really funny, odd movie. And to watch him handle both things, mm-hmm. you know, both jobs so effortlessly. And, you know, the DP in that movie was Barry Sonnenfeld.
I've had Barry on the show. He's remarkable.
Yeah, and he was a DP. He also shot When Harry Met Sally.
Yes.
And Raising Arizona and on and on with Coen Brothers movies and those big wide angle shots and so on.
Gorgeous.
And a hilarious person himself. And yeah, so I would say those two guys for sure.
Now, when you're working on When Harry Met Sally, I'm not going to ask you, did you know it was going to be a hit, but did you know that it was going to have this cultural spark as far as like a conversation about men and women? Because when you watch it, you're going, well, yeah, women and men can't be friends. And then you're either on one side or the other. I'm like, yeah, you can. No, you can't. Yeah, you can. No, you can't. Did you guys know when you were writing this, it was going to spark this kind of, it was for people listening, you have to understand, in 1989 when that came out, I mean, it was everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was everywhere.
It was a provocative. It was a provocative one-liner. Can men and women can't be friends because the sex part always gets in the way.
Right.
That was Nora's. You know, that was their premise, and then you know, handled in such a beautiful way and witty way and a very realistic way that, you know, the, and I hope this happens with here today, that people, when a movie ends, they walk up the aisle talking about it and they go out for coffee and they're talking about it. You stimulate conversation, you know, and Harry and Sally definitely that, you know, because, you know, Alex, you know, there's so much is said about the fake orgasm scene. Because nobody had really used the word orgasm, you know, in a movie except Ron Jeremy. And so.
Right. And let alone a fake orgasm. And then to have her do it on camera, that was like mind blowing.
It was mind blowing.
By the way, Rob's mother's line, still arguably the best line in the entire movie. I'll have what she's having. Oh, was it your mom or his mom?
No, it was Rob's mom.
It was Rob. Yeah, yeah.
It was the line that I wrote. So I.
The timing.
But Estelle Reiner was one of my favorite people, and the late Carl, of course, was like an uncle and aunt to me. Amazing people, but it got people yapping. That's for sure. And here it is, all these years later, people are discovering it. Younger people, and the people who grew up, who were at the right age of falling in love when the movie came out, are now telling their kids to watch it, who are now falling in love, and so the beat moves on. The beat moves on, you know. So we had a 30th anniversary screening, I guess, 2 years ago, at the beautiful Chinese Theater here in LA, and Meg and I were there, and Rob introduced us, and they brought us out on a love seat, like we are in the, you know, in the end of the movie, and
nice.
and the place went berserk. It was really nice. It was really nice.
That's amazing. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Have a rich uncle.
That's the best way to get in.
it's so hard. It's so hard. But, you know, write something that you believe in, you know, and don't ever get deterred. From your goal in your career and in your life, you know, things happen.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
I guess patience.
It's mine. Patience is the big one. And three of your favorite films of all time, as of right now, not forever, but just today, that you can think of.
Some Like It Hot.
Genius.
Both Godfather films. We'll count them as one.
Obviously. Even though obviously.
Oh, and you know, a movie from the, I guess, the 40s. Every time I see it, I cry. It's called The Best Years of Our Lives. Mm-hmm. And it just kills me. Myrna Loy, Frederick March, Dana Andrews. It's just a killer about America after World War II and soldiers returning home. When I need a bit of something, I go to that. I just adore that movie.
Now, and where can people watch here today?
Theaters only, man.
Theaters only.
Yeah.
So 2019 of you.
Yeah. Fred Bernstein, who's my producing partner, who's a fantastic person, who, you know, from the time he read the script until, till the day we open, has been just such a strength for me and the movie, always getting me everything I needed to make the movie the way that I saw it. So we had a lot of offers to stream, after a while, the streaming thing, it was great because we couldn't get to theaters, but then everything just sort of got to look like television, and we held out, and then Sony swooped in really like a month and a half ago and said, we love this and we want to put it in theaters. If America does what it's supposed to do and get vaccinated and wear masks all the time, you can get your life back. Yeah. And that's why I don't understand people complaining about it. And then that stops everybody else from, getting our life back. We can do this. Mm-hmm. And so they came in and were in theaters only starting May 7th, all across the country. I think we're in 1,200 theaters. And hopefully, Mother's Day, people will want to go and take mom and have a couple of laughs and feel something.
That's
amazing. It's a real family experience together.
It is.
About the movie.
And it does spark a conversation. It will spark a conversation without question. But Billy, it has been an absolute honor and pleasure talking to you on the show today. Thank you so much, not only for being on the show, for making Here Today, which I tell everybody you got to go see, but also for the years of just making me laugh and now making my children laugh. It's been a pleasure.
Alex, I'm a veteran.
Yeah, obviously, as a veteran actor, writer and director. But thank you so much for everything, Billy. I appreciate
it. Your pleasure. Nice talking to you.
I truly want to thank Billy Crystal for being on the show. It was an absolute honor to speak to him, to pick his brain about how he does what he does. I mean, he is truly an inspiration. So thank you so much, Billy. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch Here Today, which is opening today, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/466. And guys, I have a big announcement coming in the next few weeks. I have a new something I've been working on for a while now, and I think it's going to really help out the tribe in a big, big way, and hopefully help out independent filmmakers around the world get their projects funded, get their projects produced and distributed. That's all I will say, but I promise you it'll be worth the wait. It'll be out and hopefully in a few weeks, so keep an eye out for that. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.